welcome to Drive Through HR. Brian, William, and Nisha coming to you live every single day talking about HR with people out there getting it done. Let's get to our guest because he is going to change some lives today in 30 minutes. So can't wait for that to happen. David Weisenfeld, welcome to Drive Through HR.
Well, thanks, Brian. It's great to be with you, Nisha and William, and I really appreciate that kicking music there. Can only imagine. I cover a lot of Supreme Court stuff, and I could just imagine Justices Scalia and Ginsburg dancing to music like that.
Well, you have a much better imagination than I do then, so that's good. We're trying to expand people's thought processes here at least a little bit, at least get them thinking. So, well, if you would, let's kick it off. Have you introduce yourself, and then we'll kind of roll into what's top of mind today.
Sure. Well, as Brian mentioned, I'm David Weisenfeld, and I host the Expert HR Presents podcast series on experthr.com, and that's expert starting with an X. Just so people know, we're a soup-to-nuts compliance resource for HR pros across the country with a host of ways to help, including through news updates, podcasts, and more. And in terms of the podcasts, which are my specialty, these programs include my coverage of Supreme Court cases of great interest to HR. I also write quite a bit about these rulings. I've had the wonderful opportunity to cover in person all of the big Supreme Court cases affecting the workplace over the past decade, and certainly looking forward to talking to you all about some of those today.
Well, that's perfect. Well, so what's currently some things that the practitioner world out there needs to know about? So, I mean, we've heard a lot about, there's been a lot of press on some of the, one or two or three cases that are, have currently been decided or things that are in play. But let's go the other way, and what's something that most people maybe don't know about?
Well, great question, Brian. As you noted, of course, everyone and their brother heard about the DOMA, Defense of Marriage Act case, but there were a couple of late June rulings from the high court that really flew under the radar and might actually be of help to employers. One of those cases is Vance versus Ball State University, and it involved the question of just what makes somebody a supervisor. And that's a big issue today because for a few reasons. Sometimes, as we know, roles aren't always clearly defined in the workplace, and someone may have control over another individual's daily tasks and yet have no power to actually hire or fire them. Another reason it's a big issue is that if someone is a supervisor, then an employer can automatically be held responsible if that supervisor discriminates or harasses an employee. But if the harasser is just a coworker, then it's much more likely that the employer would be able to escape liability. So that's why this case was so closely watched. And it was a very close decision, came out 5-4, but the employer prevailed. The EEOC had taken a keen interest in the case. They had said that a supervisor both can have the power to hire or fire or simply have control over another's daily tasks. In other words, I may not be your supervisor technically, but I can make your life absolutely miserable by assigning you to clean the toilets this afternoon instead of, say, working in the kitchen or doing something else if you don't do what I want. But the Supreme Court limited the definition of supervisors to those with that actual authority to hire or fire or promote, which was a more limited definition than what the EEOC had. So the end result is that that makes it much less likely that an employer can be held liable for the actions of a worker who may have control over another's daily tasks, but if they don't have the ability to hire or fire you, then they're not going to be a supervisor and the employer can't be held strictly liable.
So can just based on the ruling, is it a case that they might be able to be held liable if it's a contentious kind of workplace that a supervisor's not dealing with at all versus somebody just I don't know. Just if you could add just a little, go a little bit deeper into that, because I think it's one of those that is, for me at least, first pass is confusing on like the difference between like a more of a hostile work environment versus just an unpleasant work environment versus who actually holds liability in not taking care of issues like this.
Sure, and in fact, that's part of what the Supreme Court was getting at least the majority with this ruling that, you know, kind of going beyond that hostile work environment, that, you know, if I don't have that act, that actual authority over you, and I'm just making your life miserable, and I'm a coworker, that's not going to rise to the level of discrimination or making a hostile work environment that would automatically make the employer liable. Now, the employer could still be liable if they know that I'm a real bad actor and I'm making everyone's life miserable, and they have that awareness and they don't do anything about it. They could be liable, say, for being negligent, but that's going to be a much more tougher standard for an employee to prove. So the end result, bottom line for employers, is it's going to be harder to sue them for liability for discrimination or harassment in cases where the alleged harasser is not an actual supervisor. And the reason this is such a big issue for HR, Brian, is that in today's workplace, you know, I might be running a committee that you're on, and or you might be running the next committee the next day that I'm on, and the supervisor lines get kind of fuzzy. And that's why the Supreme Court here is saying we don't want this to be so fuzzy. We want a bright line of who the supervisors are and who are not. So hopefully that cleared it up a little bit for you.
Yeah, no, that absolutely did. So what, that's huge. Obviously, supervisor training is probably the most significant impact that any organization can have. We do it, we have different folks that we have do it here for the SHRM chapter that I belong to. It's probably one of the most attended events every year is our supervisor training, because it's literally just cover the basics of what that actual looks like, what you shouldn't do to mitigate liability, right? And that's just something that needs to be done over and over again. So thank you for sharing that. I want to go – I actually had a question come through the Twitter stream. Where do you think policies on e-cigarettes are going? Because that's such a rage, right? All of a sudden, they weren't – 6 months ago, you really didn't see them, and now you've got these e-cigarettes, everywhere. Thoughts on that?
You know, that's an interesting question because, of course, we have tremendous limitations on advertising for cigarettes, and yet all of a sudden, kind of as you noted, just in the last few months, I noticed on – radio shows with the ads, right here in the East Coast where I'm located, that you're hearing more and more commercials for e-cigarettes. But at least so far, it hasn't been quite as highly regulated. I would think that that's going to be something that the government's going to be taking a hard look at, and we might see more limitations on that in the coming months and years. But I think it's still very much an evolving issue.
Cool. That's interesting. Well, David, this is Nisha. And I know you are an evangelist in this Supreme Court ruling cases and all the rules and regulations. And during this last couple of months, a lot of attraction is going on with the immigration laws and then the DACA, that is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival Program. And one of my personal stories, I'm H-4 visa category. So there's a new law that is also coming up, that EAD authorization, that is employment authorization, is going to be given to H-4 visa category. So from an employer perspective, there are a lot of diverse workforce that's going to enter this workforce category. So the importance of E-Verify is going to get increased day by day, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'd like to get your takes on that E-Verification process
Well, Nisha, E-Verify is a huge issue, and it's certainly something that we're following quite a bit. You see, especially, and you know, it's really an issue that breaks down among different regions of the country. For instance, in the South, many of the states, as you may know, it's absolutely mandatory for most or even all private employers to have to compliance with E-Verify in terms of all new hires and also rehires. But in some other states, in other regions of the country, it's purely voluntary for employers to comply. So really, the law is all over the map when it comes to E-Verify, and that's one of the reasons why that's something that Congress is taking a hard look at with this immigration reform that I'm sure you've been reading a lot about. And there's been a lot of talk in the immigration reform bill about making E-Verify a national requirement all across the board for the 50 states. But, you know, as we sit here today in early July, it's very much uncertain whether immigration reform is going to pass. So at least for now, employers just really have to pay great attention to their state laws in terms of whether they have to comply with E-Verify or not when it comes to all of their new hires.
Yeah, that's true. And in terms of especially preventing the identity theft in terms of employee verification processes, what do you see, what do you foresee happening in this E-Verify going forward?
You know, it's really tough to say. I do think that the momentum is that more and more states are taking a hard look at E-Verify and expanding the requirements. For instance, just last week, July 1st, in North Carolina and Georgia, just to name two, they greatly expanded their state E-Verify requirements. It used to be that unless you had 500 employees or more than 100 employees, you weren't covered. But now in Georgia, as an example, any employer with more than 10 employees has to comply with E-Verify. And in North Carolina, it's been greatly expanded as well. So I think that states are expanding their E-Verify requirements. That is the trend. Certainly not so much in the Northeast, but in other parts of the country, it definitely is the trend. And, I do expect that will likely continue.
Cool. That's interesting. So what do you say, you know, how to manage the messaging aspect from an HR perspective to their employees when there's all new laws and then norms and all coming up? So a lot of things has to be done from that base level itself, right?
Yes, definitely important to make sure all your policies are up to date, for sure. And, make sure that your policies comply, you know, not only with the federal laws, but the state and even the municipal laws as well, because sometimes there might be a city E-Verify requirement, even in states that don't make it mandatory. So that's something that you have to look out for, too.
Oh, yeah, talking about just now, as you said, the difference between federal law and the state law, and this comes to my mind as you started the discussion with DOMA. And we had a guest, one of our guests, Lori Ruderman, came last week, and then she talked about gay marriage and stuff like that. So I started reading a lot, and I understood there is a crooked thing called Section 3 of DOMA, which is very critical that federal government for recognizing any marriages between, the people for the equality, but at the same time, it's not necessary that it's the people who are legally married in their home state may not be necessarily their federal law or the programs are not applicable for them or they are not agreeing with that. I'm just still confused with that aspect. So if you can describe a little more details about that aspect, it would be a great help for our audience.
Sure. Now you want me to talk about the Section 3 aspect specifically?
Yes.
Okay, great. It's interesting because while it was hailed, as you know, as a tremendous victory for gay rights, there's a lot of unanswered questions here for employers. You know, for instance, what happens if I'm an employer in a state where same-sex marriage isn't recognized? You know, that's certainly a question that's still hanging out there in terms of what I do as far as employee benefits are concerned for spouses. And the other question, of course, is whether this applies retroactively or prospectively, meaning going forward. And those are things that, you know, this ruling really does not define in depth. But what it certainly does answer is that in states that do recognize same-sex marriage, you know, it does expand the number of employees who potentially can get benefits coverage. So certainly that is quite significant.
Well, let's, David, let me do a quick reset. Everybody, you're listening to Drive Through HR, Brian and Nisha. On with David, talking a little bit about all the pretty significant rulings that group pretty tightly together time-wise that affect HR significantly. So any kind of switch gears here, anything around kind of the national relations, the NLRB and the hodgepodge of things going on with them? They've been in the press a lot this week again.
Yes. In fact, Brian, the NLRB is very much in the on-deck circle, you might say, if you will, in that that's probably the biggest labor and employment case to watch for the next term. I know right now we're talking about what the Supreme Court just decided, but, you know, kind of under the cover of those gay rights rulings, just a week before those came out, and this didn't get a whole lot of press, but the Supreme Court announced that it would hear a major case involving the National Labor Relations Board having to do with the legality of President Obama's recess appointments to the NLRB. In other words, the five slots on the National Labor Relations Board, he made a couple of recess appointments a couple of years back when Congress was not in session. And what the Supreme Court's going to do is that they're going to look at whether those appointments were constitutional. And if the answer is they were not constitutional, then that just throws scores and scores of labor rulings from the last 2 years affecting employers into doubt. Potentially, the Supreme Court could throw them out, because if the NLRB only had two members who were legally on the board, for instance, instead of four or five, then that's not enough to decide a case. And any cases decided during those during that two-year period potentially could be invalidated. And the Supreme Court is going to take a look at that possibly as early as this fall. So that's going to be one that I'm definitely going to be watching quite closely and will have big implications for HR.
So where do you, I mean, what do you think the work at, you know, at the desk, in the trenches every day, HR practitioner should be paying attention when it comes to that?
Well, I certainly think in terms of what it's going to mean on a practical level, an area that I would be looking at would have to do with a lot of the NLRB rulings having to do with, for instance, social media. I know that's been a really hot issue. You know, the NLRB has taken kind of a very assertive, some might say aggressive approach in terms of sanctioning employers for steps that they've taken in terms of disciplining employees for engaging in activity on the internet, whether away from work or even during work. And there have been a lot of rulings on that in the past year. And one question is going to be, if the Supreme Court invalidates President Obama's appointments, what does that mean for all of those social media rulings? Because things are just moving so quickly in that area. And if all of the NLRB rulings end up getting thrown out, and I'm not saying that that's going to happen, but it is at least a possibility as we sit here on July 10th, then that's going to have big ramifications for the world of HR.
So do you think there comes a point, and this is a differential pay question. So do you think there comes a point where, you know, because everything is always on with mobile and all the access and the cloud to everything, where you know, after hours, like you end up taking a call or you end up checking something if there's amount, you know, at this time of night where, you know, it's actually logged like a time system, and you only, because it's like it's a real limited task, you only get paid half of what you usually get paid.
Yeah, you know, in fact, one of the issues, Brian, involving, you know, all of this with social media is, you know, what does it mean, say, for overtime? You know, now that, you know, I might be working more than 40 hours a week because I'm doing work outside of the office, and if I'm an employee who's eligible for overtime, does that mean I now get time and a half if I'm, you know, on the iPad doing work at my house? And certainly there's a whole host of other issues that get called into play as well. You know, if I'm on the cell phone while I'm driving and, you know, God forbid there's an accident, and you can just go on and on. But, you know, what happens if I post on Facebook when I'm working from home and I'm not on duty, but I say something about my employer that's not complimentary? You know, those are all issues that have been coming before the NLRB. And at least in a couple of cases, the NLRB has said that if I'm engaging in protected activity, you know, then the employer can't discipline me. Now, it's not to say that it's a free-for-all. I can't just say, you know, my employer just absolutely spits the bit and I hate my supervisor. You know, they could certainly still fire me for that. But if there's something about whether or not we should have a union and whether our workplace should unionize, and I just have a comment about that, that yes, I think that's a good idea, you know, then the employer certainly could be in a whole lot of hot water if they discipline me for that activity, even if I do it away from the workplace. So it's certainly a lot of food for thought.
Cool. We have some questions coming from Twitter stream, and going back to the E-Verify process, is the E-Verify being mandated in the South versus the North more due to the growing influx of migrant workers? And the question is from Josh Davis.
Great question, Josh. Certainly, I would say that is one factor. I wouldn't say that it's the only factor. You know, obviously, it's not an accident that you see in states like Texas and in Arizona, your border states, that immigration tends to be a much bigger issue. So certainly that's one reason why in Arizona that's been kind of a state that's been the leader in mandatory E-Verify. In fact, the Supreme Court case involving E-Verify a couple of years ago, in which the bulk of Arizona's system mandating it was upheld, came out of Arizona. And you see that in a lot of other southern states as well. But I also think the political climate has a lot to do with that as well. You tend to have legislatures that, by and large, and certainly it's not an absolute rule, but by and large, the legislatures tend to be a bit more conservative in many of the southern states. And the political landscape's a bit different in the North and Mid-Atlantic. So, you know, I think that's definitely another factor that can't be ignored as well. But great question.
Well, thank you for that. And the next one is from Danielle Ruport. She's asking, are the recent appointments of the NLRB actually valid to look at this as early as this fall?
I'm sorry, could you say that again, Nisha?
Are the recent appointments of the NLRB actually valid?
Oh, are they actually valid?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an interesting question. You know, in terms of what the Supreme Court's going to say, if I had to guess, I think that there's a good chance that the Supreme Court's going to say that they are not valid. You know, based on another decision from a couple of years back, in which the Supreme Court said, and this didn't involve recess appointments, but the NLRB, those rulings were thrown out that two-member board decided. You know, the Supreme Court said that they were invalid. Now, as a practical matter, if the rulings were 2-0, it didn't make a big difference. But in cases where there was some sort of split, it certainly did. And I suspect, if I had to guess, that the Supreme Court in a close decision may well say that these recess appointments are invalid. You know, in terms of what I think, I think that recess appointments are nothing new. I don't think it's anything different or anything unique to the Obama administration, but I suspect the Supreme Court's going to have a different view.
Well, they, the Supreme Court definitely usually does have a different view.
That's right.
Oddly enough. So we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left here. What's something that is just on the fringe that maybe is just kind of coming maybe on your, you know, in your, I guess in your screen, so to speak, or around employment law that most people just haven't really even started thinking about yet?
That's a great question. You know, Brian, I'll answer that two ways. One, I'll just mention one other Supreme Court ruling that some people might not be aware of, a case called Texas Southwestern versus Nassar, that also seems to provide an extra safeguard for employers. It involved a doctor of Middle Eastern descent who claimed that he lost out on another job offer because his former employer badmouthed him and discriminated against him. And his discrimination allegation was based on the fact that one of his supervisors had once made a couple of derogatory comments in his presence that could be construed as discriminatory. But the Supreme Court said that's not enough. The doctor needed to show that the former employer wouldn't have acted but for those discriminatory reasons. And without that, the employer will win the case. And that's significant because while it doesn't give employers carte blanche, it has the effect of making it easier to get certain retaliation claims against them dismissed. Now, the second answer to your question, just in terms of general trends that I'm watching, another one that I would mention, a big one, involves ban the box laws. And what I mean by that is the box on initial job applications that we've all seen that asks if you've ever had a criminal record. The problem is those questions knock many people out of the box, pardon the pun, before they even get a chance at a job interview. And they tend to disproportionately affect minorities. And a growing number of states are now saying that those questions are illegal. In most states, these requirements have just applied to public employers, but there's now 3 states where it's private and public employers. So multi-state employers really need to take note of these growing prohibitions.
Well, and that's, the job application is just a, between job applications and job descriptions, I mean, that is like one of, two of the biggest train wrecks there ever has been. So good highlight on that. We've only got about a minute left. So where can folks, maybe are you going to be at conferences? Are you speaking? Where can people connect with you and follow what you're writing and what's going on, David?
Well, thanks for asking about that. They can definitely check me out at experthr.com. That's expert with an X. I write a lot about these Supreme Court issues, but also about all sorts of recruiting and hiring issues involving Ban the Box, E-Verify, and many other things. They can also check out my tweets, at David Weisenfeld, and certainly hope to be out there at more SHRM events as well. And I appreciate the opportunity to be on with both of you today.
Well, we definitely great information. I mean, that's one of the areas that you just have to be as proactive forward. And we appreciate you sharing all that, folks. We're out of here. And I'm going to break my rule and Kevin Gross in a little while.